Okay, so we're at the top of page 18 in Sack's book on Leviticus, and the first citation is the very first sentence, in italics, so obviously it was important to him as well. The universe is the space God makes for man. The holy is the space man makes for God. I think that's so interesting and so important. The universe is the space God makes for man. Isn't that interesting that the biblical perspective is not about, quote unquote, the vastness of the universe, and we're just a, you know, minute little fragment in this huge cosmic galactic expanse. But basically, it's the other way around, that the universe was created specifically for a space for us to occupy. And that's really interesting. And then, of course, what he's pointing out is wherever that occurs, wherever the universe is created in such a way that it's built for men to occupy, can't be the place where the holy occurs, because that would, you know, that would bring it inside the realm created for men. So he says the holy is the space man makes for God. And now the question is, okay, how do we do that? And then he says in the next paragraph, in biblical Hebrew, the opposite of kodesh, holy, is chol, which means empty. Chalel means to violate, desecrate, profane. Halal means to hollow, avoid, empty space. Okay? It also means dead, slain, bereft of life. Hence the paradox. Space or time that is unholy is full of finitude and therefore empty of the divine. Space or time that is holy is empty of human devices and desires, an emptiness filled with the divine presence, the glory of God. We make space for God in the same way that God makes space for us, by tzitzim, self-effacement, self-renunciation. That theme is going to happen again and again and again in Leviticus. I mean, I'm just working now on some citations from page 149. It's the same thing. But isn't it interesting when Christian natural theology runs around looking for God in the universe, it violates this very thing that Sacks just talked about. Because what he's saying is, when you look inside the universe, you can't find any empty space. And empty space, emptiness, is the location of the divine. So space and time, space or time, is holy because it's empty of human devices and desires. And isn't that interesting? Think about that in your own life. If you really want to experience the presence of God, you have to empty yourself. I mean, don't we find that same theme showing up in the apostolic writings? And yet here it is in Leviticus, the same idea that the presence of God can't be experienced where we're occupied with ourselves. Okay, at the end of that, the third paragraph on that page, he says, the priests are the guardians of the sacred and must themselves be kept as far as possible from the ordinary, the mundane, the mortal, above all from death. So isn't it interesting? Because we think of death as the cessation of life, the emptiness. But in fact, in this view, it's still part of the created order. So it itself represents the complete paradox of the creation. It's a place in the creation that's empty. But it's not an emptiness of holiness. It's an emptiness of basically defeat. So he says over on page 19, it's the last paragraph before we get to the subheading on sacrifice. The holy is where transcendence becomes eminence, where within the universe we encounter the presence of the one beyond the universe. Holiness is the space we make for God. And, of course, that means to honor holiness is to make an empty place that's filled with his presence, not just an empty space. Okay. So on the next page, 20, in the middle of the first paragraph there, he says, the Jewish mystics called the manna Nahaman Dekushfu Fa, the bread of shame, because they had not worked for it. In Judaism, when you enjoy what you have not earned, it is a source of shame. Wow, think about that. Think about what he just said. When you enjoy what you have not earned, boy, has the world come a long way from that. Okay. And then finally at the end of that page, in the italics, he says, later, Jewish law recognized giving as an integral part of human dignity when it ruled that even a poor person completely dependent on charity is still obligated to give charity. Giving is essential to self-respect. To be in a situation where you can only receive, not give, is to lack human dignity. And wow, if you think about how if you think about Leviticus as the fundamental document, the constitution of Jewish society, think about how important these insights are to the way that a society should function. First, think about the statement that enjoying something you haven't earned brings shame, right? So what does that say? It says that a society can only function when the people who are in it understand that work is absolutely essential to human dignity. And then he says, even the poorest of people who is dependent entirely on charity is still obligated to give. And of course, what he's saying there is no such thing as an open welfare state. Even those people who are recipients of welfare are still obligated to do something for someone else. There's a complete interconnectedness of persons. And it just seems to me that those two missing ingredients in the Western world today have resulted in all kinds of chaos and despair and dysfunction on the half of society and the half of individuals, because we've forgotten what the fundamentals of the civilization were that were built on this Levitical document. Okay, now we go over on 21. And he talks about the second story is the building or the binding of Isaac, in which God stops Abraham from sacrificing his child. At the next paragraph down, he says, however, the form of sacrifice is secondary to its essential principle. So here's the principle of sacrifice. And of course, Leviticus is all about sacrifice, the principle. The fundamental sacrifice in Judaism is that of the will. Since freedom of the will is the highest gift of God to man, we may acknowledge that it is a gift periodically to give some of it back. That is why the service of God is called avodah in Hebrew, the very word that's used to describe the slavery of Israelites to the Egyptians. And avodah, of course, you know, is the word for work, and it also means to serve and to worship. So what he's saying is, this is really interesting, that the notion of sacrifice in Judaism is not just bringing an offering. It's this whole idea of working, worshiping, and serving all together. And he continues that. We see here that the intimate connection between a religious vision and a political one, just as it is idolatry to worship human beings rather than God, so it is slavery to sacrifice our freedom to other human beings rather than God. Wow. I have a bunch of exclamation points in the margin there. It is slavery to sacrifice our freedom to other human beings rather than God. So any time in a society that we're asked to sacrifice our ability to choose in order to placate some authority, we're actually entering into slavery. And the only slavery that matters, the only one that actually benefits both us and the divine, is as Yeshua says, slaverson. Okay. So 22, top of the page. The Hebrew word for sacrifice, the verb lahakriv and the noun korban both mean bringing close. The meaning is, we are brought close by what we bring close. We come close to the other God by bringing a gift. A gift means I take something of me and dedicate it to you. A gift can be a way of maintaining a relationship. It can be a form of apology, a desire to be forgiven. It can also be a token of thanks. One way or another, a sacrifice in Judaism is always a token of an I-thou relationship between us and God. It is a gesture of love. Okay, so now we should reflect on that. What he's really said is, sacrifices are the vehicle by which we connect with the divine and express our thanksgiving and our gratitude. So that changes the whole basis for the Levitical order of sacrifices. Now, when we look at the details, none of them are rules about rituals. They're all intended to enhance this idea of drawing close. And that makes a huge difference on how we understand what's actually happening when we get all the details about a sacrifice. He says in the middle of that, in the middle of the third paragraph on that page, there is no love without the willingness to sacrifice. I wonder if that's applicable across the board in humanity. There is no love without the willingness to sacrifice. And then he further defines holiness in the last paragraph. Holiness has to do with our relationship with God. Morality has to do with our relationships with human beings. Two of the most striking features of the Torah are that, one, morality is universal, whereas holiness is particular, and that, two, morality takes precedence over holiness where the two conflict. Thus, holiness is no excuse for a failure of morality. And you know what he just said is the basis for Yeshua's parable of the Good Samaritan. It's exactly the same thing. The parable of the Good Samaritan is a conflict between holiness and morality. And Yeshua points out, just as Leviticus points out, that morality takes precedence over holiness, right? The priest who's concerned about holiness cannot go and help the man who's destitute on the side of the road. So he doesn't understand Leviticus. He doesn't understand that morality overcomes and takes precedence over holiness. The Good Samaritan who acts with an intention of human morality actually turns out to be the one who expresses the greatest degree of holiness. Right? Interesting that we would find in Yeshua's parables an exact representation of this Levitical principle. Okay, so the last paragraph or the last comment here on page 23 about this topic. It's at the end of the first paragraph there. The prophets did not oppose sacrifice, but they saw very clearly how the entire structure of temple worship could be misused to anesthetize consciences that should not be anesthetized. And we can apply that, I think, pretty easily today. So the prophets railed against the lack of social morality, but not against the notion of sacrifice. Why? Because what they realized is that people use religious ritual to excuse the lack of social morality. They would basically say, you see how religious I am, but in fact never did anything to act in ways that were moral in relation to other people. And you can see that in Yeshua as well. Remember his comment about do as the Pharisees say, but not as they do, because they will tell you all these wonderful things that you're supposed to be doing, which were moral issues, human to human, but they don't act that way. So they use holiness as the excuse not to be involved in social morality. Okay? All right. So now he's going to enter into a discussion of purity. But let's pause right here and see if anybody has any comments on this one section about sacrifice, because now we're going to move into a different theme. So I'm open to discussion. Somebody got something to say, Ed? Oh, George, it's nice to see you here.
Yes, yeah, nice to be here.
Thank you. Okay. So what do we got? Anybody want to make any comments about sacrifice? Have you thought of sacrifice in that way? That it's that the drawing close has nothing to do with the actual, the actual ritual of sacrifice, but is actually intended to create this opportunity for making the relationship stronger, which of course spills over into the issues about morality. No? Okay. Well, then let's continue. Go over to, go ahead.
Oh, just most of us don't realize that the whole book of Leviticus is all about drawing near, and sacrifice is one of the one of the most important things, but morality, you can't approach the tabernacle in an unclean state. So morality is the most important. The sacrifice, you never go before a king without something in your hands to present to them. And we're blessed enough to know what it is that pleases him that we can bring. So Leviticus is all about drawing near. The tabernacle is all about drawing near.
And that's a good point, that you can't enter into this religious ritual without what's called being clean. But it's interesting that one of the criticisms that Yeshua makes is that some of the Pharisees considered themselves clean because of their religious practices rather than their moral practices. So when we say you have to be in a state of cleanliness, it's interesting that that means that you have to have this correct moral relationship with other human beings before you can enter into a sacrifice that's acceptable for closeness to God. Yeah.
Important. And the Good Samaritan, right, the Good Samaritan test. The story of the Good Samaritan, the gentleman on the side of the road, was a test to find out if their hearts were pure.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. And religious ritual had absolutely no power to excuse their behavior. Right. Brenda, you had something?
Yeah. Hi. Back on page 21, the last sentence in the first paragraph where it said, thus the permission to kill animals for food accompanied by a solemn warning against murder was intended as a way of channeling violence out of human condition. That blew my mind. I have kind of always wondered why we ate meat after the flood, but really, that's the reason? Maybe there's something deeper there that I'm not seeing, but that's kind of crazy. I mean, wouldn't there be another way to outlet our violence than killing animals? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe there is another way not to be violent, but the whole point is that, as he says, we're back on page 21 now, the result of a world filled with violence, which began with Cain's murder and Abel. Right? Thus, how does that end? It ends in the flood. So the reason the flood occurs is because of the violence and idolatry of men, right? But you don't just wash that away. You submerge the water. It's still carried over, right? In the DNA of the people on the ark. So the permission to kill animals for food, accompanied by a solemn warning against murder, was a way to distinguish. God doesn't say you shouldn't kill at all. It's never proposed that way. It's you shouldn't murder, but killing is, as a result of this, is still a part of the human condition. Unfortunately, we're no longer vegetarians. We've learned how to become carnivores, and as a result, Sachs is suggesting, which blew your mind, is that if you allow the killing of animals for food only and for no other purpose, then you've given a way to what's the right word? I'm thinking of the psychological word that allows you to get rid of a feeling. But right, in other words, you have this pent up anger, and how are you going to deal with that? Well, God says you can't deal with it in terms of other people. And so there's only one legitimate expression for it, which I think you're right. It's a really important and interesting comment that he makes here. Cause you don't think of that. You might question why in the world would God allow the killing of animals after the flood? And maybe his suggestion is correct, that it's a way of dissipating that kind of behavior, but only in a way that makes it proper.
Yeah.
Would that be the problem with violence today, is that most people don't kill animals on a regular basis? We don't kill for our food. We go to the grocery store. So.
Yes. But somebody still had to kill the animal to get it in the grocery store.
I know, but it's not.
Yes. But
we're not doing it ourselves.
Yes, that's right. We're not. Except, of course, when you really follow the ritual of the Passover and you're involved in the killing of an animal. And by the way, now that we mention that, isn't it interesting that the killing of the animal at Passover requires you to actually allow the family to bond with the animal before it's killed, so that you feel the experience of the death of the animal? It's not, you know, it's not impassionate anymore. It's not handled by some extraneous mechanical process that you're not involved in. If you really go through the ritual of the Passover as required, you will in fact be the one who slits the throat of the lamb and let it bleed out after you have embraced that lamb. I mean, it's so interesting that you were required to care for this animal for a certain number of days before you slaughter it. So that gives you a chance to actually realize not just the intensity, but the enormity of what you're asked to do, to kill, for you to find some sort of reconciliation means that you have to enter into what is the experience of causing death to something. It's really an important issue that we don't experience anymore because we let all that become grocery store stuff.
Well, maybe going to the grocery store has become a really bad thing for us because we don't understand the sacrifice that an animal made, and the family doesn't have to work to, you know, clean it and everything. Yeah. And so an appreciativeness.
Skip.
Yeah, it's interesting. That it's interesting in the movie. Just let me make this one comment, Maddie, and I'll come back to you. It's interesting in the movie Avatar. There's a leftover, maybe unintentional, but it's certainly there, a leftover of this very idea. Because when an animal is killed in the movie Avatar, there's always a religious ritual that goes on, the thanking the animal for giving its life so that something else can survive. But we don't have that kind of connection at all anymore, which is a real, really says something about our own sensitivity to the issues of life and death. Okay, now Maddie, then Michael, then Lise and David, then George, everybody's got their hands up. So Maddie, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to quickly confirm what I think you said is, I think maybe you can read it differently. It wasn't that if I'm angry, I go kill an animal. It was to, when you go through that experience of killing an animal, that aversion should make you not want to kill animals or to murder.
Oh, yeah.
Handling it out of the human condition.
Yeah, good point, because we're so removed from the actual process of death that would not have been the case for the people that are reading this text for the first time. So, yes, the very act of doing this is an act of, like Avatar, experiencing how horrible death is, even if it's necessary for the survival of another species. So,
yes.
Okay, Michael, you have something to add?
Yeah, you're talking about on Passover how they had to, you know, bring the lamb into the house and become familiar with it and love it and everything and then kill it. And it reminds me the same thing happened to Yeshua in that, you know, his disciples drew close to him and then, you know, ended up denying him and in essence, you know, killing him. And I wonder if there isn't some sort of similar thing that we go through, not just, you know, raising our hand, you know, at church saying, I accept Jesus, but actually learning to love Jesus and then ultimately, you know, I don't know, denying him and killing him and then being reborn. I don't know, something along that line.
Well, certainly the parallels are probably there in the gospel accounts. excuse me, but the interesting thing is how closely it follows the Levitical process, right? So now we're talking about the, and remember we had this previous comment about the issue with death that he makes about the emptiness of the holiness. And he talks about death as the ultimate experience of emptiness in the human world. Well, now we're seeing that the same Levitical patterns that show up in the gospel accounts are fundamental to our idea of how to draw close. And what God does, I believe, in the Passover is allow each one of the Israelites to experience the trauma and the horror of what it takes to redeem, right? That you have, in order to be passed over, you had to actually sacrifice the life of something that you had learned to love. It's really quite an amazing thing. Okay, Lisa and David.
Yeah, Skip, two years ago I had the experience, I have a friend far from us who raises sheep and goats and things, and she asked me to help her slaughter three of her lambs. And I went through that experience. It was a very, very heart-wrenching experience. I found myself subconsciously asking forgiveness to those lambs before I put the knife to their throats. And yeah. I found myself looking up to God for, you know, thank you for this.
Yes. And I think that was the intention all along, that we should experience that. So far removed from our antiseptic Western ideas, but that certainly wasn't the case to the people that this was written to. Yeah, a really good point. George, you had something
else? Also, the understanding of it was to, so that we would also understand the pain that God had in having to kill the firstborn also, because he didn't hate the Egyptians.
Yeah,
you know? Like, it's just part of the whole process. But by killing the lamb, there was that sense that could be transferred to understanding God's heart also in the whole event, you know.
Yeah, and there's that great rabbinic midrash, which where the angels are cheering because the Egyptians are being drowned in the sea, and God reprimands them, saying, aren't these my children too? So yes, there is a really important lesson here about how drastic the actions are that are necessary for redemption and for restoration. It's really important, I think. Okay, so can we continue? We're on page 23. Yep. Okay, so let's go. My next comment is on 24. At the bottom of the second paragraph, if there's a hand up and I don't see it. Oh, Estera, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't see you. No? Okay. All right, so on 24, the bottom of the second paragraph, the last sentence, he says, before there were laws of purity, death did not defile and waters did not purify. The laws created a new reality, but that does not mean that they are irrational or incomprehensible. Man, you can underline that about 20 times, because that is the definition of a paradigm. What he's saying is water and death are just water and death. But when you enter those concepts into a paradigm, you change their meaning so that now they become something that defiles and something that cleanses, right? This is really important, because it's the paradigm that alters the reality. And once you enter into the paradigm, you see reality differently. Right? That's actually what he's describing here. So now we've learned something else about Leviticus. Leviticus is paradigmatically dependent, but once you enter into it, it reshapes all the ways that you think about the, you know, ordinary living, right? So this is really interesting, because dietary laws don't tell you that, you know, shrimp are bad for you. Dietary laws are paradigm boundary conditions, but they work from inside the paradigm. So when somebody tries to explain that you shouldn't eat shrimp because it has health consequences, they've missed the point. It isn't about the health consequences. It's about the shift in the paradigm that forbids and permits certain things. And as he says, just because they're forbidden or permitted does not mean they're irrational or incomprehensible. They're just inside the paradigm thinking. Okay? At the bottom of the page, he says, the connection between this and the purity laws is that In this chapter, sin is described in terms of defilement, and atonement, among other things, is described as the process of purification. So isn't that interesting? Because now what you realize is that, and we knew this before, sin is a religious concept. It's not an ontological concept. It belongs inside a religious package, okay? And in Leviticus, sin is about defilement. That is, something that on the outside would be completely ordinary is now treated as prohibited because of the paradigm. And as a result of the paradigm, sin is defined in terms of these things that defile, which otherwise, if you weren't in the paradigm, they wouldn't do that, right? So, and atonement is described as the process of purification. That is, whatever was the process before, whatever the action was before, bathing, for example, is just bathing. But once it's inside the paradigm, it takes on a different meaning, and now it changes the reality of how you understand what these things mean. Okay? So he says, on page 25, the third paragraph or so, yet God listened to Moses' prayer. He understood that the Israelites needed to feel that God was in their midst. The answer, therefore, lay in boundaries, clearly demarcated lines, rigorously supervised by the priests and fastidiously observed by all. If the holy is the space we make for God, then purity is what allows us to enter that space, and impurity is what prevents us from doing so. Okay? So this is really interesting, because now we've redefined pure and impure in terms of the boundary markers that Leviticus puts in place to allow holy space, right? At the very bottom of that, he says, hence, the supreme source of impurity is death. Contact with or proximity to a dead body. Why is that the supreme source of impurity? Because it's exactly the opposite of God. Right? God is what does Yeshua say? God is the God of the living, not the God of the dead. And the whole point is that rituals that involve I wouldn't want to use the word adulation, but that's not exactly right. Rituals that circulate around the religious importance of death miss the entire point of what's happening in Leviticus and in the Jewish faith, right? Because it's not a faith about death. Death is the polar opposite of the God of Israel. Okay. So. Oh, and that has a really interesting implication for the Christian adulation of the cross, right? So get this. In Jewish thinking, the cross is an absolute insult to God, right? Because it is the Roman marker of power over life and death. So it's absolutely an insult to all Jewish thinking, right? The open tomb seems to be the appropriate symbolic representation of Yeshua, but not the cross. Yet Christianity has focused on the cross, and you see that in every church. So you might ask yourself, why does Christianity essentially worship death and not life? There's a long history behind that, of course. Okay, so now we're on page 26, and I really have marked the entire last paragraph. I want to go through that kind of carefully if we can, where he says, holiness and purity depend on the ability to distinguish, separate, and know what belongs where. That's essentially a paradigm activity, right? Because of the paradigm, this goes here and this goes there, okay? That is the logic of the dietary laws in chapter 11. Recall that God created the universe in the first chapter of Genesis by bringing order to chaos through the act of separating domains. It's the same idea. Light and dark, upper, lower, sea and land, etc. God then fills each with its appropriate objects or life forms. The dietary laws have the same logic. Clean animals, fish, and birds are those that most conspicuously represent order. Lobsters are impure because, though they live in the water, they walk as on land. Okay, so I want you to get what's happening here. We're not saying lobsters are impure because of the garbage cans of the ocean. we're saying they're impure because they participate in two different kinds of orders at the same time. Amphibians are impure because they lack a definite place. Most fish have fins and scales. Therefore, those that lack one or the other blur the line that separates fish from other life forms. Ruminants are permitted because they eat what God first ordained animals to eat, green plants. By the same token, carnivorous animals and birds of prey are impure because they eat flesh, something forbidden at the dawn of time, and so on. Whatever blurs boundaries is unclean. Now, think about that in our modern world context. Whatever blurs boundaries is unclean. And the entire political spectrum today is consumed with blurring boundaries. Right? So he says at the top of page 27, the same logic applies to sexual ethics in a more profound way. Nothing is more disruptive to social order in the long run than sexual anomie. Human offspring have by far the longest period of dependency of any life form and therefore depend on strong and caring families. The relationship within the family, husband, wife, parent, child, are the most common metaphors throughout the Tanakh for the relationship between God and people. This goes to the heart of Judaism as a religion of fidelity, loyalty, and the love that brings new life into being. Judaism is neither hedonistic nor ascetic. It is about the consecration of desire. That is what is at the heart of the two codes of forbidden sexual relations in chapter 18 and 20. And we looked at chapter 18 and 20 with Rabbi Zev, and now we have a format that we can put that in. Namely, whatever blurs boundaries causes confusion, and that confusion violates the order that God set in place in Leviticus and consequently is sinful because it destroys the order that God intends for human beings to live in order for them to draw close. Okay? So he says, middle of that same page, 27, this is the Torah's form of chaos theory. As the beating of a butterfly's wing can cause a typhoon on the other side of the earth, so small breaches in boundaries can lead in time to anarchy and tyranny. Do we really think that blurring the boundaries of the Western world for the sake of social justice is actually going to improve anything in civilization? If we understand the Levitical paradigm, this is only one more step in the total destruction of the civilization. And then he says in the last paragraph, two or three sentences in, the purity laws exist only because Israel was called on to become a holy nation and only because through the tabernacle, God caused his presence to dwell in the midst of the camp. That is why the purity laws are specific to Israel. Isn't that interesting? Right? The purity laws only matter to people who are living inside the paradigm, and the paradigm is intended for Israel. So if you want to exercise your choice to draw close to God in terms of the purity laws, you have to enter into the paradigm of Israel. There's no other way because the laws were intended to work inside that paradigm, and that paradigm belongs to Israel. Of course, it belongs to the Tanakh, so we're reading the Tanakh and we're learning about this, and therefore it will also belong to us. But isn't it interesting that there's no insistence that it has to be adopted by all of humanity? Okay, Lise and David, you have something?
Okay, so when I read that, my question was, aren't the Jews supposed to be the light to the nations? And so if there's something that God gave them that's very crucial to the way the paradigm works or the way purity laws work and your relationship to God, why would that not be taught to the nations?
Ah, okay. Very good. So, why isn't it taught to the nations? Okay, and we have the answer to that in the story at Sinai, where God says that when you live according to this constitution, when you live in this way, the other nations will say, how is it that you're so blessed? Tell us about your God so that we can enter into the same paradigm. In other words, it's a it's a an apologetic of attraction, right, rather than of compulsion. So the whole, and you see that in the prophets too, where they said when, you know, 10 men will grab onto the tassel of a Jew's garment and ask to be brought along. I mean, the whole point is that God intended the Jewish population to live in such a way that the rest of the world would want to emulate it. Okay? So that really brings up some interesting points as well, doesn't it? Because the more confusion and the less boundary protection that goes on in Israel, the less magnetic attraction they have for the rest of the world. And since they have less magnetic attraction for the rest of the world, no one's interested in becoming part of their paradigm, right? It's a really interesting thing that's happening there, because God's intention was you are to be a holy nation first. You're to live according to this paradigm and emulate these boundary conditions. And as a result of that, you will be a royal priesthood. A royal priesthood is an intercessor between one party and another. You can't be an intercessor if you don't show that you're operating within the paradigm. So, very interesting thing has happened politically, and that is that the Orthodox Jew, who's the most likely to be working within the paradigm, has over the course of history become the less interested in recruitment, right? They don't do proselytizing. They don't do, evangelical work. They don't do any of that because, as a result of the pressure of human history, they've isolated themselves in order to maintain this paradigm. But the result of doing that is to frustrate the intention, which was to create a holiness that would be an attraction to the rest of the world. We, by the way, in this group, are only here because we're attracted to this idea. We want to also feel the presence of God. And insofar as Orthodox Jewish people feel that presence, we want to experience. How can we do that? Well, we need to enter into that paradigm. Michael, you had to add something?
Yeah. Your hand is up. He said it kind of shoots himself in the foot. He says it's only because through the tabernacle that God causes presence to dwell in the midst of his people. So obviously there's no tabernacle, therefore, ergo, no presence of God. So, which is probably why they want
to. Okay, so first. Yeah, well, that's certainly part of it. But first, remember that he's talking about the audience as that the document was written to, right? So historically, of course, it is the tabernacle, right? So the tabernacle, of course, is the symbol, we're going to get to this later, is the symbol that God uses to demonstrate that he actually is in their midst, okay? So, you're right, we don't have a tabernacle, we don't have a temple, but does that mean that we no longer have the presence of God in the community? I'm not so sure. We'll have to look as we go through this book about what happens when the Levitical space is removed from the population. Do we then lose the presence of God, or are we all seeking another way to experience that presence by not ignoring the requirements of the paradigm boundary conditions that would allow it to happen in the first place? And I saw your note there from Lindy that said that the Orthodox community is open and welcoming. It's just that we don't experience that too often. So, yes. So, Lindy, you want to add something?
No, I was just going to say the most, I think, listen, people are people, so you can't go by 100% of them, but the community that is attempting to represent exactly what that is Chabad. You know, they are open and willing to talk, and for the most part, and they don't judge.
I agree with you. Chabad is really an important community. Absolutely. Yeah, I've enjoyed a lot of conversations with rabbis in Chabad. That's great.
Right.
Okay, Michael, one more comment, and then unfortunately I got to run to the stage. So, Michael, go ahead and make your comment.
Nope, I just forgot to take my hand down. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Okay, so unfortunately, people, in 4 minutes I have to be on the stage, so I'm going to have to cut it off here. But, I mean, there's such wonderful things happening in this second look at Leviticus. I'm sure that you're like me saying, oh, my gosh, how come I didn't think of that before when it's right there in the text? So next week, let me see, where will I be next week? Next week, I will be in Naples, Italy. Isn't that wonderful? And no matter what happens in Naples, I will have an onshore connection. So we will not have any difficulty, although we didn't have any today, which is wonderful. And we'll just spend the extra 15 or 20 minutes next week to make up for the so that we can catch up with. Is that acceptable to everybody?
Okay.
So. Sorry, I have to cut short today. I have this obligation on the ship, but I will see all of you next week and we'll just continue and learn some more good stuff. Okay? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye. God bless.